episode 22 with myself.
Where meditation meets daily life, this is the Meditation Freedom Podcast.
Good morning. This is a hot day in Southern California, and I sat this morning in meditation at about, what was it, 6 o'clock or so, and there was an earthquake, a 4.1 earthquake, just about 5 miles northeast of us in the valley here. It was quite an interesting experience. It was a rumbling and a shaking. It wasn't a big one. It was a 4.1 earthquake, which out here in Southern California, that's considered a very small earthquake. A lot of people will sleep through it. But it was interesting to experience that out here in the desert while meditating. And the reminder that, of course, we're not on solid ground and the ground can be pulled away anytime, just like it happened in Nepal a few weeks earlier. It's clearly a reminder to pay attention and not to take things for granted. I figured, well, this episode, I'd talk a little bit about one of the reasons I started meditating, because I was quite reckless. My guess would be like most of us, you know, especially when we're young, and we think we will live for a long time, and we probably don't really totally appreciate aging and falling apart and the fact that we're going to die too, just like everyone else. So I figured I'd talk a little bit about one way to look at how I got into meditation. And then, just so you know, the next couple of weeks, I'll probably post a small episode as well for just a meditation, a guided meditation. I know Christina, my wife, has made one, and we made one together for YouTube, and I figured, well, why don't I just put that on a episode here, and then you can let me know what you think of it, if it helped you in any way, or if you want to see more of that type of stuff, too. Hopefully, I'll be able to resume interviewing after our move is completed. So getting back to this episode, and I want to just give you a couple of reasons why I started meditating today. And I believe actually that there's a lot of different reasons that bring us to a meditation practice. You know, the interviewers, the guests have had all kinds of different reasons why they started meditating. And that's kind of interesting to see all that. So it's kind of interesting to see how people get to a meditation practice. And in some cases, people aren't really even sure what particularly triggered it, or they can't pinpoint it. And I can't pinpoint it either in my case. I know there's lots of different factors that played a role, and I mentioned some of that in my introduction episode, episode 1. So in this episode, I just want to look and play from a different angle and see where it goes and just kind of explore all the various factors that play a role in starting a meditation practice, and then the motivations behind keeping a meditation practice. And since I can only speak for myself, I have to draw from my own experiences. So in this particular episode, I'll look at some of the things that I experienced and some of the things that inspired me. Now, I can mention some of the more positive things that brought me to a meditation practice, but let's look first at some of the messed up things that motivated me towards a meditation practice. Sometimes things go wrong before you see that you want to do it a different way, a more kinder way than you did in the past. And, you know, one of the things that I have a lot is curiosity. And usually that's beneficial, but you can also see how, and I can look back and see how it combined with a tendency for distraction and self-absorption or self-centeredness, this curiosity can turn into a much more destructive force, like recklessness or complete disregard for others in the environment. And I know I had lots of that as a young person. And as I look further into this episode, you'll see that, you know, we all have that. And we still do, even when we mature and think we figured things out, we still are messing things up. So there's definitely plenty to look at. So I'll give you a couple of examples of me being a reckless teenager or child, and just kind of see what happens when you're reckless and curious with some ignorance mixed in with it. Now, even though I was fairly sensitive at a young age, I was plenty reckless too. Like, for example, in terms of my sensitiveness, you know, I remember as a kid, I didn't like it when other boys, typically boys tend to be more destructive, you know, would go and pull legs out of a spider or something like that. Just that's kind of a curiosity that is destructive. But I've done my own fair share of recklessness too. For example, I would used to go to this trash heap, and this was a friend of my father's who had a houseboat, and I would row to this big trash heap that was on a separate dock. And I don't know why people dumped trash there, but they did, and I'd love to go. As a kid, that was fascinating to me, so I'd go and row over to with my little rowboat, and then I'd go and grab stuff, electronics preferably, that was my interest, and I would see if I could bring it home and then fix them. And oftentimes, I would end up getting extreme intense electrical shocks, and it's 220 volts down there in Europe, and that was pretty dangerous for me, actually, to be tinkering with that and putting my fingers in these electrical radios, defective radios or Christmas lights or whatever I was pulling out of the trash there. And so this is an example of me being, you know, pretty reckless and a disregard for safety that was an endangering of myself. I noticed as I grew older as a child that I always had something, you know, some toe that was injured or something like that. So I, you know, that at one point I actually paid attention to that. And I remember thinking, gee, you know, every month or so I have something. And it seems like I have continuously some kind of an injury that I caused to myself. And so that was an example of where I became aware of my own sloppiness or recklessness. And how it started bugging me, and I wanted to be a little bit more attentive so that I wouldn't be, you know, always having a cut or blister or something or burn somewhere. For example, I would be playing with fire. That was fascinating to me. Fireworks, fire as a young person, totally fascinating. I'd light an ashtray. The first time I think I did something rotten was when I lit an ashtray on fire in the house, and then I couldn't figure out. I didn't expect the amount of fire, and I ran up to my parents upstairs, and because I couldn't figure out how to extinguish the fire. So that was the first example, and luckily that all went fine, but it could have turned into a big fire. So, you know, a small little thing that I can laugh about it now, but if it had fallen on the floor, geez, you know, I could have burned down the whole house with my parents in it. Not intentionally. These little accidents can turn into big disasters or tragedies real quick. One of the other things I did with fires was we had these metal trash cans in the park where people walk their dogs. And I thought, oh, wouldn't it be interesting if all the cans were kind of smoking? It'd be kind of an interesting effect in the park. So, you know, I'd lit up five or six trash cans, and every few hundred yards, you'd see a smokestack coming out of a trash can. So these are some of the examples of where I was not thinking about the effect on others. I was just completely self-involved and, you know, just curious in a more destructive way. Especially as a teenager, the way I was able to vent was by blowing up things, or, you know, blowing up fireworks and stuff and buying fireworks. And as I grew older and met my wife, for example, she said, you know, that hurts the animals, that the animals can hear seven times as loud, you know, especially dogs, and dogs will run off from their houses because they're scared from the fireworks. And when you're still very much invested in wanting to do something, you just go, yeah, right, you know, that's, everybody does it, so what's the difference? Anyway, so another example would be riding a bike without brakes. I remember just picking up a bike that somebody else had dumped, and I figured, oh, that's a nice bike, but it didn't have brakes, so I would ride a bicycle without brakes and use my feet as brake pads. This works some of the time, but other times it would turn into me bumping into things. Or I remember passing a couple of people once and with a bicycle and being kind of reckless and rushing, and there was a piece of ice and I slipped, and sure enough, the two people landed on top of me and we had a big pileup. So that's another example of being in a rush and causing myself an injury and then causing other people trouble. Now, the most dangerous occasion was when I had fallen in love with somebody in summer camp in France, and with a Dutch girl. It came back to the Netherlands, and I would frequently listen to music while bicycling and completely involved in music. I loved music, and I would love riding my bicycle with the music on. The problem with that was that I was busy, you know, fantasizing or romanticizing, and here I am on my bicycle not looking the other way, and sure enough, I got hit on one intersection. It was totally because of my lack of attention, or at least my fragmented attention, because I was so involved in the music that I was not paying 100% attention to the bicycling. And that was a strong collision. It was a car that must have driven at least 40 miles an hour, and it mangled the bicycle and threw me across the car. And I remember time slowing down. So there was a very interesting part of that whole experience. But, you know, ultimately it was a recklessness in myself that caused that. And I've had to pay for that with back type issues ever since. So the experience was fascinating because I felt the time slowing down and I got a few days off school, and I don't remember really feeling bad about what I did as much as being fascinated with the experience itself. But now looking back further, you know, I can see that I really had a problem with being present and being attentive to each moment and being non-distracted when I was doing something. So with all these injuries, of course, I started to realize even then that I was very clumsy in the attention department. That probably was one of the things that motivated me towards a practice of attention. And it took me, I was pretty young when I started reading lots of spiritual books. I remember reading lots of Hindu type books and being very attracted to Zen. And I don't remember the first Zen book that I read that really made an impact on my thinking and the direction I wanted to take with this. But I was very attracted to the simplicity and the no-nonsense directness of Zen, and the emphasis on it, and direct experience. And then the results that it was talking about of peacefulness, the wisdom and understanding, and the clarity, and as well as the grace and the deep appreciation and cultivation for each moment. So one story in particular got my attention as a teenager and drew me a lot closer to a Zen meditation practice. And I don't remember which book, so sorry about that. But in the book, there's a story, and I'll kind of paraphrase it because, as I said, I don't know the name of the book, so I can't look it up and see how much I've changed the story. But the gist of it, you'll get the gist of it based on my interpretation or my retelling of the story here. But basically, it's a story about a monk who gets out of the monastery at night frequently to hang out in the city. And this wasn't part of the monastery routines, so he was basically flaunting the rules here and escaping the monastery every so often to go probably drinking sake or whatever he was doing. But it's not so much about him violating that rule with the monastery. What really stuck to me was this story, how maybe some teachers or head monks would have just chastised him and said, hey, you know, you either stay in do the monk life or you leave the monastery. But this particular teacher didn't do that. He followed the student around, and that's what makes this story interesting, because he observes him and then the next day calls in the monk and has a little chat with the monk. And he says, you know, I saw you getting out last night and you climbed over the fence and then you went into town and you crossed some city street. And because you were not paying attention, you bumped into this woman, and this woman maybe was carrying a baby or groceries, and they fell, dropped on the ground, and you just kept walking. And, you know, this woman was already stressed, and he could see that in her eyes. By you bumping in her, you triggered, you know, additional stress, and you escalated her already stressful mood. And so as she was cleaning up and perhaps more hurried herself and her own mood worsened, she then went into a store and maybe got agitated and yelled at the store attendant there or the store owner. And that store owner maybe had just lost his wife or lost somebody important to him. And so he was already sad. So this yelling perhaps propelled him into a deeper sadness. And so basically the teacher goes on and talks about how all these little things that his own lack of paying attention had a ripple effect onto the circles around him, the people that he comes in touch with, the people that he encounters. So in other words, you know, just because he was in a certain kind of place, that doesn't mean that the world around him wasn't affected by that. And I think that as a young person, that really impressed me with how, you know, our own mind, state of mind, our attitude and our behavior affects others in ways that we can't even have any ideas about. And there's such a ripple effect to our own state of mind. It's not easily measured. And that's probably one of the reasons why we haven't really delved into that as much as a society and as a culture, because if you can't measure it, then it's pretty hard to say, well, here's what causes what the effects are of your state of mind. You know, here's how it affects this part and that person and that person. You can't, since they can't really measure that, it's easy to turn our heads in the sand and ignore the effects of our own minds on others. You know, that's one of the reasons why I was so appealed by this story, because it really was, in a way, it allowed me to visualize, hey, you know, my own state of mind really does affect others. And there are consequences. Just one story in a book really, really impressed me. And at that point, I started taking steps towards a present moment type practice, a attention practice. And it took many more years before I actually started joining a formal Zen lineage or Zen group, a Zen community. But the seed had been planted in my mind that I needed to do something. Now, you may say, well, that's great for you. You've got, you know, clearly you had a very clumsy childhood, but, you know, what does that have to do with today? What does that have to do with people who don't always injure themselves or don't make a big mess out of each day? But as I said in about that story, it is very subtle. And, you know, I just had a good friend of mine over yesterday, David Bainbridge, and he's written a whole bunch of books about, he's kind of a pioneer in the alternative design, sustainable design and ecology movement. And he wrote in one of his new books about the desertification of the Southwest. And he talked about how back in the day when there was not only a boom in gold out here in California, but there was also a boom in the meat industry. There was a huge demand on the East Coast for meat, and there was plenty of land in the Central Valley, and so there was lots and lots of money to be made. And farmers would go out, and cattlemen would go out in the Central Valley and start bringing tons and tons, hundreds of thousands of cattle, and they would graze every piece of grass, every blade of grass. And then whenever you had a drought cycle, it was no longer sustainable because the cows literally had shaven off every living piece of grass like a razor blade. And now they had this surplus of cows that they couldn't feed anymore. So, and they couldn't sell them all because, you know, every other farmer was trying to sell their cows. So you couldn't even sell them for a dime or a quarter. You know, they would make all their money and they would move on to another animal that could eat the other pieces of plants that the cows didn't eat. So they would go on to sheep and they would make all their money with the sheep And after that was all gone, they would go and sell off the sheep and move on to camels or other animals that could eat the cactus. And they went as far as even burning off the stingers, the needles off cactus, so that the camels or whatever animal they had could eat those. That's one of the main causes of desertification in the California, but also this kind of story has repeated itself in Australia, and you know, you're seeing it now in China, and so you're seeing more and more desert as a result of our insatiable demand for meat and animals. It's not just individuals like myself who are reckless, but it's us as a group, as a community, as a species who are reckless with our land and with the environment, with the world we live on. There's a tendency for all of us to not think much farther than our own lives, our own family, or our own country, and not think of consequences for future generations and other countries and maybe other animals. And so, you know, we all struggle with this. There's no doubt in my mind that we all have attention and awareness and consciousness, our lack of it, and our need to become more conscious so that we can have a place for our great-grandchildren to still live on and enjoy life. And one of the interesting things about this is that, you know, pretty much all organizations that are dedicated to protecting the environment, they won't talk about an issue like animal agriculture because we all as a species are still attached to eating the animals and the products of the animals, like dairy, even though the resources required to do this are way more than we as a planet could sustain. If all 5 billion of, or I don't know how many billions we have now, but 7 billion people, if we all wanted to live like that, it's impossible. We could not grow enough corn to feed to cattle so we can get a little bit of meat out of it or a little bit of dairy. So this is a struggle. And I love dairy. I grew up with both dairy and meat. It's been hard for me as well. I'm mostly vegan, but it's still a struggle sometimes to say, no, no more cheese, no more this, because of the impact on the environment. And so this is a waking up process. It's a process of becoming more conscious. It's about weighing off, is my own needs more important than the needs of future generations or the planetary family? Anyway, I wanted to briefly mention that because it's one of those issues today that even despite all our scientific prowess and global consciousness and so forth, we still struggle with that as a nation, as a species. You know, how do we minimize our harm footprint? And our water footprint is just one of those pieces of the harm footprint. And to me, that's just one of the reasons to have a show like this too, is, you know, we're still got plenty of struggles, we still got plenty of challenges, and we still have plenty of waking up to do. So why not talk about it and explore it with other folks and see what they think and see what you think, you know. So feel free to leave a comment on meditationfreedom.com/22 and let me know what you think. Is this interesting to you or related to practice? That's all I've got for today, and it's going to be up at 102 or 103 degrees out here in the desert, so we got to turn our machine, our swamp cooler, back on, and we turn it off so that I can record without all that noise in the audio. But it's going to be a cooker, so I better get off the microphone and turn that machine back on. So thanks again so much for listening, and I hope you have a wonderful rest of the week. Take care.
Thank you so much for joining us on the Meditation Freedom Podcast, where meditation meets daily life.